Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So the Media Project is underway from Northeast Public Radio. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Rosemary Armeo, investigative journalist and professor at the University of Albany.
Hello.
Now tenured Professor Armeo, isn't this a wonderful thing? So you can say whatever you like and you can't get fired.
I know, it'll be such a change.
As though, yeah, as though you haven't always said what's on your mind. You can't get fired from the university job. Here,
yeah, it's
watch
a different
yourself.
Matter.
And introducing folks, if you haven't heard him before on some of the other programs here, Kevin Moran. Kevin, welcome.
Hey, thank you.
Kevin is currently still managing editor of the Berkshire Eagle based in Pittsfield, Mass., but he is more importantly now vice president news of New England newspapers, which are...
Which include the Berkshire Eagle based in Pittsfield, the North Adams Transcript in North Adams, Mass., and the Bennington Banner in Vermont, and the Brattleboro Reformer, Vermont.
Whoa.
And we've got a few other publications thrown in there as well. So yeah, I have the Berkshires in Southern Vermont to contend with now.
Wonderful. And this is all a part of a company known as...
Digital First Media.
DFM, right.
Yes.
Same. Now, which is now the same company that Ira Fussfeld, whom we often hear here, has been a part of. Digital First, well, has incorporated a couple of different companies now.
Yes.
But it includes the Denver Post and how many newspapers around the country?
I think it's about 70 dailies 70 throughout
dailies.
The country. Yeah. Digital First Media is, think of it as the umbrella organization that manages the Journal Register Company, which is now known as 21st Century Media, and the Media News Group side of things, which is the flagship being the Denver Post.
Okay, so we are ready to get underway here with the Media Project with some of the issues of the week, we hope. One significant notion is we might actually start, Rosemary, given your academic experience, that journalism programs are supposedly taking a lesson from teaching hospitals as a way toward moving into teaching.
I read that, and it's also a model that we use overseas where the media development model had been to give money to existing organizations and let them go at it. And instead, when we've gone over there with American editors taking Bosnian and other local reporters, had them do all the work when we were just kind of directing and editing. And it's learned by doing. It makes sense to me. I love it. I read that article. I'm taking it back to my faculty meeting, Rex.
What a great idea. You know, Kevin, you've hired a lot of young reporters in your time. What kind of background do you find best equips people to do the job?
You know, it may not necessarily be a journalism background straight out of school, but one of the things that I think is key is just a certain curiosity about the world.
Oh, yeah.
Writing certainly helps.
Yeah, you know,
knowing how to tell a good story well.
How to move people.
And how to move people, yeah.
And you are right. I find that many of my students are good writers. You know, they have been directed into journalism because they have writing skills, but the curiosity to, how about this? What do you think about this? And they'll just, many of them will just sit there. It's very strange because I don't know how to teach curiosity.
That's correct. And you definitely need that. It's like peeling back the layers of an onion. We can all get the paper off the onion, so to speak, but it's continuing that innate curiosity that allows a good reporter to dig even a little bit farther than you think you actually need to at the onset of a good story.
Especially now when so much of our work is not just writing stories for tomorrow's newspaper. When I get young applicants coming in and I say, why do you want to be a reporter? If they say to me, well, I've always loved to write, I feel like, well, then you should go write. Because what we do is we report. And sometimes the best way to report is with writing. Sometimes it's with videography or photography, or sometimes your best reporting nowadays can be a string of tweets. If you're covering breaking news, that is often the best way to cover it, rather than worrying about transition sentences and The kinds of stuff that you think about when you're writing.
It's a little daunting, the skills that are needed by journalists now. I frequently wonder if I would have gone into the field if I were starting out now then, you know, in the mid-centuries, well, the middle of the last century when I did. You know, data journalism, databases, analysis, graphic design, that is really sophisticated and requires math. You have to be very smart to be a journalist these days.
Yeah, it's an exciting time, I think, to start out to be a journalist. I think programs like the one that's taking place down in Alabama is certainly one of those programs which seems to touch on all the bases, because you're exactly right. I mean, from Twitter to data journalism, to envisioning how data should be presented to our readers, either in print or basically online right now. It's not just, let's write a story.
Yeah.
It's how can we present the news?
So the program in Alabama involves not only the master's in journalism isn't just about on-campus coursework, but a full-time residency in a newsroom for a year as well. So that's what it is.
And more importantly than residency in the newsroom is you live in the community in which the newsroom is located.
Right.
You become part of the place, and you talk to people casually, not just to go in and ask your 10 questions to get your information. You become a part of the fabric of the community.
And I think there's certainly the benefit of having an intern or a person in a college program who's wanting to become a journalist spend time in a newsroom doing it. You just can't beat that experience.
Yeah. You know, one of the interesting things is we used to value, I guess we still do value the ability to be a generalist in journalism. Turner Catledge, the longtime managing editor of the New York Times back in the 50s, said, give me a good General Assembly reporter, put him on the face of the moon, and he will file by the 5 p.m. deadline. That was the notion before we ever imagined we'd actually go to the moon. Nowadays, though, there is a level of specialization that's required because we do need that depth. We can't just get by with the superficial. If we're going to differentiate our content in journalism from the general observations that citizens can make. That is, there's so much information out there that superficial really, I don't think, is going to cut it going forward for journalism.
I love this dichotomy. Journalism in the 20s in this country was, you know, a feel for drunks and ne'er-do-wells. You had a flair for writing and kind
that's
of be
changed.
Bold. Well, it is. We're boring now. We sit in rooms that look like insurance rooms. We're upper middle class and staid. And yeah, it's much more professionalized. And as I said, I think your journalists are smarter now. We've lost some of the kind of daring and fun of the 20s and 30s. It somehow has to be both.
Agreed. And yes, you do have to be a specialist too, but you have to have that background as a generalist.
Yeah.
And you're exactly right. I mean, there is literally so much to do in a reporter or editor's workday now.
Yeah.
There is no downtime because you can be doing something. And quite frankly, if you're not doing something, tweeting or monitoring the world around you, you seem not to fit in a new newsroom anymore.
This is really hard to get the change in culture going in a newsroom. And, you know, many of us miss that rollicking old newsroom. I remember when I was a young reporter at Newsday, a guy threw a spike at me. You know, nobody has spikes on their desks anymore.
Oh.
But Tom Demoretsky, this old time cops reporter, my problem was I was whistling as I walked across the newsroom. There is a superstition that says it is bad to whistle in a newsroom. I didn't know that. And he threw a spike at me
in the neck. That's the problem.
I don't think he intended to hit me with it. I don't know. And so while we miss some of the drunks in the newsroom, the great stories that are there, people do expect more and we have to deliver more. But it does make you think that the journalist of today, while we may still have these charming old characters, we may have a place for the slugs who don't present themselves well. You know, you really almost have to have people who can speak on a microphone or even and can
or
handle
take
a camera.
Pictures or a camera, moving pictures, video we call it these days.
Right. Moving pictures.
You put me back in the past, Rex.
The New York Times is moving forward now with new international editions, and I think this is a part of this. They are adding people to their editorial board, which I think really is of a piece with this, because their opinion pages can no longer just be filled with the generalized writings of opinion writers who speak to their community here in New York. So they've added an Egyptian writer and a political columnist for the Sunday Telegraph, a Turkish columnist, a Bangladeshi writer.
Mm-hmm.
How different is that from the newsrooms of the past, right?
Very different. I, again, as someone who's worked overseas, and I've just seen this explosion of journalism done by internationals, foreigners, and it's all worth reading. Part of it is that English has become so widespread, we now can read what they write and understand it, and I welcome this.
Yeah, this is going to be must read. I think readers are probably going to come to this edition and be challenged by it, quite honestly, because they're probably going to get perspectives that they're not prepared
for, exactly,
you know, to hear. So I think that'll be great for readers.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be a great thing. It is always interesting when you're traveling overseas, even looking at CNN International is different from, of course, CNN America. And you look at the news that other people around the world are getting, it is quite different from what we're getting. We get a little bit of a flavor of it now with Al Jazeera America. You know?
I even liked reading President Putin in our papers.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. It's a great read.
Yeah, controversial foreign contributor.
Now, speaking of old time folks, Rosemary, you lost a colleague. You used to work with Bill Marimo, who was just fired from the editorship of the Philadelphia Inquirer. And I think it's worth, even though none of our listeners probably know Bill Marimo, it is worth making note of the fact that when an editor is fired from a newspaper, it's a big deal. The Philadelphia Inquirer, one of the grand labels in journalism. I knew Bill from, I was actually a Pulitzer juror with him one year, brought him in to talk to our staff, a good old-fashioned news guy, right?
He is, and that's what's gotten him into trouble. Bill is one of the, if not the best editor I've ever worked for. He's an amazing journalist, a double Pulitzer Prize winner in investigative reporting, which is a hard trick to pull off, and loves the Philadelphia Inquirer. That's where he won those two Pulitzers, where his whole career was won, and did the same sort of job in Baltimore and lost his job there as well. It's because he won't fire journalists for bad reasons. And he's not so enamored of all the electronic gizmos. He understands it, but he doesn't want to make it the focal point, I think, of his editorship. He wants that to be good stories, well told, wonderfully researched. You can tell him squarely on his side.
It's quite something. He's sort of a throwback, if you want to say it that way, to the old style of editor. We don't know what got him in trouble, but it does seem that there's a paper trail that his publishers kept showing where Bill departed from his publisher's wishes. And I guess the message is, you work for the publisher.
I don't think he cares about that. I think he cares about the larger field of journalism. I also would note that he has a daughter, Anne, who is a fabulous journalist. Also, she works at the Washington Post. So he knows how to produce good journalism at home and in the office.
Excellent. You know, when I became an editor, I learned that there really are, I think, three constituencies for an editor. You work for the enterprise, you work for the community that you serve, and you work for the staff that you lead. Those three constituencies sometimes come into conflict.
That's interesting.
And you really have to figure out where you're going to find your balance.
Very true.
But ultimately, only one of those will fire you. So it's important to bear that in mind. One of the places that we need to go is to talk about one of the iconic names in journalism these days, which is 60 Minutes, ever since it went on the air in the 70s. 60 Minutes has been a great brand in journalism, but there has been what seems to have been a very questionable bit of reporting by 60 Minutes.
Have you seen that? Have either of you watched it? Oh,
I
wish I had.
Sunday
I've read
night,
about
yeah.
it.
It was,
what did you think?
It just seemed something that's just not ringing true.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the piece, I think, was kind of all over the place because at first it was very general. Then it was kind of a gotcha piece on these guys who are being brokers to get people on disability benefits through the Social
right.
Security program. And then, yeah, of course, as Michael Hiltzik points out in a recent piece, that basically 60 Minutes really screwed up because they took this story in a direction in it that they didn't even interview disability advocates, he points out. And of course, what a huge gap.
Yeah.
Not to go there. And now sort of reading this perspective and then thinking back on that episode, I feel like I've been duped.
The piece did look at the problems with the Social Security Disability Program. But as you say, Steve Croft fronted it for CBS News. And it's always a question when you have a correspondent's face on these big stories. How much did the correspondent do? How much is in the hands of the producer, the associate producers? Because these are really team projects at that level of network journalism. But to do a piece that basically says that the program has become, quote, a secret welfare system ravaged by waste and fraud, those were Steve Croft's words in this, to do that without interviewing a single recipient of the 12 million people who receive Social Security disability programs, the number actually is 10.9 million, not 12 million, as CBS reported. 8.8 million are disabled workers, 2 million of them are family members, mostly children. And those numbers have grown significantly, but that's partly just demographic.
It's part of
we've
the
got more
population.
People.
Yeah, yeah.
more people and more old people.
It will be interesting to see how 60 Minutes responds to what has been very strong criticism of this story. Will they come back and do a follow-up, a correction, an apology? I'm going to watch it this week.
Well, I think there's something really interesting here is that the 60 Minutes piece painted a rather broad brush there. And obviously, you're talking about a federal program with millions of people involving millions upon millions of dollars. A program that actually, for the most part, I think we can all concede, really helps people. Mm-hmm. And sure, there are probably a large sum of people who are gaming the system and doing what have you. But you didn't really come away from this piece with that understanding.
You just thought it was all bad.
Yeah.
That's kind of a warning right there.
It is. And it plays into the hands of the anti-government crowd that is very popular these days. And so I'm sure that there's some resonance for this story. You could, I suppose, ascribe some ulterior motive to CBS in wishing to air this kind of a story, because CBS is often criticized, as we all in journalism are, for being of the liberal elite. And so by seeking to attack government programs, that does seem to counter that.
Makes it look more balanced, huh?
Yeah, they're imbalanced. What a notion.
Bad journalism for balance. Great.
It seems that way. So this is The Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. If you were just joining us, I'm Rex Smith in the Times Union, Rosemary Armeo, investigative journalist, and Kevin Moran of New England Newspapers. And we need to talk about fact-checking. Fact-checking is increasingly prevalent in journalism. We have different sites that do it these days. PolitiFact has set up shop in a number of states. And it turns out, according to research at Dartmouth, politicians actually respond to this, that when journalists fact check their work, it changes what the politicians do.
I am shocked.
They pay attention to us.
They do. Yeah, this was a great little study put on by a couple of folks from Dartmouth College and apparently the University of Exeter. And if I understand the project correctly, they picked a slew of lawmakers in the country and basically sent one group a letter saying, look, we're watching you. They sent letters to a third of the group that said, hey, you should be aware that somebody might be watching you. And then there was a control group. And then they, at the end of the whole effort, sort of stood back and watched to see how accurate the lawmakers and politicians were if they knew that they were under the microscope or under the magnifying glass of the media. And that was interesting results.
I agree that it was interesting. I liked a quote from PolitiFact, an editor at PolitiFact, which, of course, is one of the great fact checkers. They've made that an art. And she said, our job is really to tell people stuff, to inform them, not to affect politicians. But, you know, we did notice that if they think we're going to be fact checking, if our guys are there, they're a little more careful in what they say.
Less likely to fib.
Yeah.
Isn't that a great outcome? You know, I don't think it's a bad thing at all for a journalist to say my goal is to have an impact on public policy if that impact is to foster truth-telling. I mean, that is, yes, our goal is just to give people information, but there has to be, I think, in the back of our minds, why do we want to give people information? It really is to create a better society. I mean, ultimately, it's most of us go into journalism not to make money. I know this is shocking.
Good thing for that.
Good thing.
You won't.
But really to have an impact, and that impact is to make our communities better. And if you do that by forcing politicians to tell the truth, well, that's a good thing.
I always liked when journalists picked up on tips from the public. They would call and say, this is not right. Can you do something about this? And it wasn't even really a story. But if you called someone and said, I'm from the whatever newspaper or outlet it was, and I want to ask you about this, you would get a change. You would,
yeah,
you would
true.
Help people
yeah.
change things just from the fact that you are inquiring. And that is the role of a watchdog press.
It's really frustrating when you're trying to put out a column, for example. You know, we have a column called The Advocate, where our columnist Chris Churchill stands up for little guys, and he will find something and he'll ferret out wrongdoing or
a mispayment or a bill that didn't get handled right by a big
right,
politician.
Exactly.
Or a big
and
utility.
The frustrating thing is that when Chris calls and people immediately fix things as a result of his call, it ruins the column, you know, because you want to... Oh, well, we still managed to find a way around it. One of the things that, for example, Chris has done, which I think is worth noting here, because this has become a big story on social media and on legacy media around the country, and that is the story of Brian Holloway, the NFL player who had this home in Steventown, right on the New York-Massachusetts state line. And Holloway was a forgotten retired NFL player until his second home in the hills in Steventown was the site of a party by some teenagers, which they brought broadcasts on social media, including pictures of them partying, and they kind of trashed the place, apparently. The problem is that as this story got out, and as the more and more people found out about it, it was picked up and carried by all kinds of folks, with Brian Holloway claiming that there was tens of thousands of dollars of damage and that there were hundreds of kids, and the claims became a bit outrageous, frankly. And our Chris Churchill actually has been sort of the truth teller on this, has been saying, wait a minute, to the claim that parents, for example, have threatened Holloway because he exposed their children, that they are going to sue him. There is no substantiation. There is no evidence that that's true. But it was repeated many, many times by media, both locally and nationally, to the claim that Holloway has made that there was a Woodstock-style plan for 4,000 people to come party at his house. No evidence to support that that is true. So sometimes your job as a journalist is simply to point out, even on kind of on less important issues than the matters that we're covering in public policy, your job is to point out when somebody is fibbing. Yes, that's the word. Exaggerating, perhaps. There we are. And to find stuff that people don't want. In Washington, we are told that the Obama administration is, according to David Sanger, a longtime journalist, the most closed control freak administration I've ever covered. What is going on there?
Well, he keeps going after leakers, putting them in jail, following reporters. There's quite the evidence of this. Ironic, since he came into office, one of his first acts was to open up freedom of information to make sure that journalists supposedly could get information they wanted. And he promised openness. But in fact, it is extremely scary, the stuff that's going on. We've never seen this, even under Nixon.
Or making suspected leakers take lie detector tests.
Yeah.
I mean, that's... I don't want to call that Orwellian, but if it gets close to that, I mean, it seems like an apt description.
And the effort has been, I think, to shut down bureaucrats, to shut down officials so that they will not talk to journalists. But that still has the effect of he's attacking the press.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think, in your years of experience, do we have more leaks now?
More leaks now. Well, you know, here's the interesting thing. There are more ways for people to leak.
Mm-hmm.
There is a greater opportunity for people to put out stuff through social media. There are ways to get information to us without being identified, though we end up needing sources still. You know, we need to be able to confirm who sources are. The difficulty is that even on a local level or a regional or state level that we tend to deal with in this community, when there is this kind of retribution for people who leak at the national level, it scares sources of all kinds. And we need to have people inside tell us about stuff, or else we can't find out what's going on.
I think there's always been leaks. That's the way the press has always worked. What has changed is the way information is kept. So you can have a low-level official like Chelsea, not even an official, she was a soldier, a low-level person have access to thousands of documents and can leak them. And the technology of leaking has improved. You can hook up to WikiLeaks is just one of them. Many, many organizations, including the New York Times now, have ways to leak to them that keep you safe. We didn't have that before. So it is different.
And certainly there's a lot more for the journalists to do because there may be so many pots of information. Our job now becomes more complicated and sometimes more laborious because we actually have to test the veracity of those documents. Are these the real thing? They look authentic, but are they the real thing?
Absolutely. A very good point. And that's often hard to do. Well, on that point, we've got to leave. You know, it hardly seems possible that we've gone through.
Thanks for having me.
Kevin, it's wonderful to have you here. Kevin Moran from New England Newspapers, Rosemary Armeo. I'm Rex Smith. Next week, we believe Alan will be back. What's it like without Alan?
It's he'll tell us it's boring.
Yeah.
We're kind of colorless, guys.
We are.
Really were.
Oh, well, we'll be better next week, folks. We'll see.
In corruption, crime, and gore. Ding-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy. It's